There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We're here for Thursday. It's the culinary highlight of your week. Thursday brunch show, and I'm very excited to be joined in the studio by the world famous and entrepreneur Chef Michael Mina. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. I know you're not in Dubai for too long, so I really appreciate you coming in to take the time. I'm also joined, my co-host for this afternoon is Adrien Villadieu, executive chef at Inc. at Al Sakal Avenue. Hello, Adrien.
Hello, Hélène. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hélène. This is what I like. I'm feeling very lucky. I've got two very charismatic chefs and food on the way. I really, really couldn't be happier. We're here in the Dubai Eye Studio until 2 o'clock, talking food, food news, and also trying some delicious dishes from Chef Michael Mina's brand new restaurant opening on Sunday, Four Seasons DIFC Mina Brasserie. Now, Chef, thank you. I was there last night for a little sneak peek taste.
Thank you.
Huge congratulations.
Thank you.
Opening officially on Sunday, and I was just so impressed by, obviously it's called a brasserie, but it felt so dynamic and fun, and it's really kind of far away from the stuffy kind of brasserie feel that I think so many people are used to. Was that the intention?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I think that that was the intention. Obviously, being from the United States and wanting to bring a little bit of the, you know, what we call an American style brasserie, but that kind of gives you a large canvas to work with as far as cuisine, because America is a melting pot. And so really being having the luxury of having been involved now with this restaurant space for a little over a year and a half, and having the opportunity to start, you know, to create a new concept in it, but still take what we've learned. And what we definitely have learned is that, you know, the ambiance is so important here.
And it's beautiful.
Thank you.
You know, these things matter. It's like beautiful pale blue leather banquettes and the chandeliers and lovely tiled floors. So it's, I know it shouldn't matter, but in this age of Instagram, let's be honest, it matters.
It does matter.
Adrien, you're exec chef at Inked, which is a blank space really for these things. You guys get to put your own stamp on it.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different from a restaurant concept, whereas you get to do this from the beginning, and the Mina Group is now responsible for how many restaurants worldwide, Chef?
36 restaurants worldwide.
36 restaurants. So for a little bit of background, born in Cairo, in Egypt, and then raised in Washington, and then started your career around 1987, going with Charlie Palmer and then moving to San Francisco.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Now, decades later, you've had numerous awards. I won't be able to get them all here, but we've had Who's Who of Food and Beverage, Silver Spoon Award, Bon Appetit Chef of the Year, San Francisco Magazine Chef of the Year, Restaurateur of the Year, and Esquire Best Restaurants issue. So congrats on all of that.
Sounds exhausting.
Yeah, you look well for it. You really do. What was your ambition when you first started as a chef?
You know, I think that I was fortunate to grow up in a household where, you know, it was a Middle Eastern household, and food and the social aspect of lunch, dinner, dining as a family and as an extended family with relatives and brothers and sisters was always at the forefront of our house and our home. And when I was 15, I got my first job in a kitchen, and by the time I was, you know, 16, I was very fortunate to know that that is 100% what I wanted to do with
my
life.
What was the first job? Were you doing pot washing?
Pot washing, bussing, and then sneaking behind the line and begging to get to flip an egg or
just touch any food in any capacity.
And bothering the, you know, I wouldn't say it was a chef, but bothering the cook enough to where he would let me cook a little bit. And then, you know, working my way into cooking. And honestly, by the time I was a senior in high school, I was actually kind of in charge of this little restaurant that I was working at.
So
and
a real
that's
double
what happens
life.
In the restaurant business.
Really?
You get promoted very quickly.
Student by day and then chef by night.
From student to chef.
If you're willing to do it.
Adrien, you were early when you started as well.
Yeah, I had the same thing. You know, you start like begging for like doing potatoes, and then you try to touch a plate and try to be in the service, and then you're in the line, and then you don't even know you're already a chef de partie, mm-hmm. and you're plating, and you're like, wow, that went fast.
Mm-hmm. So quick exactly. promotion through the ranks. Yeah. And then going on to culinary school.
Yes, and then I went to in the United States, the school that I think is the best school in the United States for sure is the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park in New York. And I went right after high school and then got my internship at the Hotel Bel Air in Los Angeles. And from there, I actually met Charlie Palmer, who was opening Oriel in New York City. And so my second year of school, I was able to go down and do what we call stage, where you go down and you get to work in the kitchen and you get to learn. And so I did that my second year. Ultimately, my goal was always to live in San Francisco and to open that. My dream was always to be in San Francisco.
What's the big appeal for you as a person and as a chef?
Yeah, you know, I grew up on the West Coast. So when I was 13, my family, really the only significant trip we ever took that I can remember in my childhood was to San Francisco. And it was the first time I was even exposed to anything as delicious as a croissant or a perfect, cappuccino or anything from in the culinary world at that level. And I just had these really amazing, vivid memories of that trip. And you're obviously so impressionable when you're young, and so I was set. That's where I was going to live.
Eyes on the prize. Yeah. And you did go to San Francisco.
I did.
And now that's become, in fact, I think it's very fair to say you're instrumental in turning San Francisco into a real culinary hub. That's now what you're famous for. You're based there?
Yes, I'm still based in San Francisco. The second day I lived in San Francisco was the earthquake. And so
no.
I thought to myself,
is this a sign? Yeah. A good sign, a bad sign?
Good
he's
sign,
landed.
Bad side. It took a little bit of convincing to myself, but I stayed. And
that was to open Aqua.
Yeah, and so then I opened my first restaurant, which was Aqua, and it was an all-fish restaurant. And it was next door to the oldest restaurant in San Francisco, which was also an all-fish restaurant, very different style,
okay.
called Tattage Grill. And it was really became an enormous success. And knock on wood, it was I think that the part about Aqua that was so magical for me was because it was a fish restaurant, I was not tied to any one style of cuisine. It wasn't ever labeled as an Italian restaurant or a French restaurant or a Japanese restaurant. And so in the spirit of San Francisco, the wealth of talent that's in that city was very diverse, the people we had working in the kitchen. And so the menu was always such, besides being all fish and having so many beautiful varieties of seafood to work with, we just had such a talented group of cooks that were from all over the world. And it really, I think, helped shape my career.
And it was where you got the Rising Star Chef of the Year Award, 1997. Yes. Was that your first award?
That was my first major award, yes.
And over the years, which award has meant the most to you, Chef Michael?
I would still say it was that one. I would say that it was because that was an award throughout the whole United States, and it's through the James Beard Foundation, and you have to do it before you're 30. And it was something that, it's hard when you're young to really get the, not just get the notoriety, but really get the respect that, that you really need as a chef. And an award like that really helped shape my career for me.
And then going on to open a signature restaurant. What kind of pressure is that to have a restaurant named after you?
You lose your name, which is really interesting. Everyone said to me, they're like, you won't have your name. Your name won't be yours anymore. you'll be talked about in third person. And,
or just the last name.
Yeah. It's enormously rewarding and satisfying too. It's a lot of pressure, obviously. you know, nobody else is going to be blamed for anything. But then again, you know, I think what's so magical about what we do is there's very few professions in life where you can get the immediate gratification that you get from being a chef. You know, in the, you know, you can dream something up, you can go in and bring all the ingredients in and cook it, and that night you can be, you know, serving it to 20, 30 people will eat that dish, and you'll know immediately how you did.
It was a good dream or a nightmare.
Yeah.
So that was opened at in California Street, San Francisco, and awarded a Michelin star.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Congrats.
Yeah. Thank you.
And how, what was that feeling like to get that Michelin star?
It was amazing. It was actually, the restaurant actually opened, the original one opened at the Westin St. Francis, and it was a little more formal than the one now. I moved it back to my original space, and that one actually, when Michelin first came to San Francisco, when it first came out, I got two Michelin stars, and that's just something that, you know, obviously you, as a cook, you just, you know, that's what you strive for, that's what you dream about, that's what you talk about with your whole crew every night. That's what you talk about. Those are goals you set for yourself. And usually it goes one, then two. It was interesting for us because we got two, and then you lose them when you move locations. You lose your stars.
And just automatically?
Automatically, yeah. So you can't. And so when we went from
brutal.
Our first location, and I had the chance to buy my original restaurant back, and we actually went for a little more casual feel at the time. That was kind of where the economy was heading. And so I was still happy to get one Michelin star when we reopened Michael Mina, and now we're working to try to get back to two.
Good stuff. And welcome to Dubai again. How many times have you been here now?
Oh, probably 10.
You like it? That's a
I
very
love
leading
it.
Question.
I
do you
love
like
it.
Dubai? You yeah. do? What do you like about it?
Well, it's, you know, again, it's, you have such a diversity of people that are here, but I just really, I enjoy the speed in which everything is done here.
I mean, sometimes,
yeah. it's interesting because just every time you come here, for me, not being from here, and then every time you visit, it's amazing what has been done.
Yeah, what changes.
Yeah.
I'm joined this afternoon by Chef Michael Mina and Adrienne Villeneuve. We are talking about food and news, and when we come back, it's your chance to win dinner for two at Mina Brasserie. Stay with us. I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by world-famous chef Michael Mina, my co-host, exec chef at Inc. Al Sakal Avenue, Adrienne Villeneuve, and also Chef Matt Dalcamper, exec chef at the Four Seasons and Mina Brasserie. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
In very good company this afternoon. We are talking food news. Adrienne, you've brought in a story that's kind of piqued your interest. Can you share?
Yes, exactly. I was obviously really attentive to the Michelin guide that went out last Monday in France, so it was quite a big deal. I think a lot of my friends are watching football and basketball, and me, I was watching live Michelin stars. Yes. And people were like, okay, this guy is weird.
Chef's life.
But yeah, there was some interesting stories. Obviously, I'm French, so I'm following a lot my colleagues in Paris and in that region. So we were some of them very surprised that they didn't get any stars, and some of them not happy that they got one, basically. So it's
not
a bit
happy.
Of like...
What do you mean, not happy that they got one? What's
no,
that about?
I mean, sometimes we do feel that Michelin, especially in France, is complicated to understand. The process behind is very difficult to get the proper way they really release it, you know what I mean? This year was very focused on south of France and all this region, and we feel like Paris and some other places were a bit left over, and there was some really good things that were happening, but we were a bit sad on some other chefs that should have deserved a Michelin star, or that are fighting for it since 10 years or 15 years. And you know, sometimes the guide is looking at you and they're just wait a bit more and wait a bit more.
It's a power struggle.
Yeah, and Chef Michael was saying it, like, you know, to gain one, I'm sure it's like amazing, and to lose one, I'm sure it's like devastating, but then you have to fight for it, which is also very nice for our job, because we fight for that every day, you know. And there was like a big thing happening, because Mr. and Mr. Bras, the two chefs from France, they decided to stop with the Michelin guide to give back their stars.
They gave them back?
Yes, they gave them back their stars because they were saying that it was too much pressure for them and they couldn't really reach the real way of they were cooking before. So they wanted to get back to that reality, sourcing products and stuff like that, which was maybe like too much pressure for them. And that's what the chef tried to explain every time. You can have like, sometimes the Michelin is like pushing you, but sometimes the Michelin is like stepping you back from what you really want. I think, because obviously I'm not a Michelin star chef.
But you've worked in a lot of...
I've worked with 2 and 3 stars Michelin restaurants all my life, so I know, but Chef Michael, I'm sure, can answer much more like on that. But I think it was really interesting to see that they decided to remove the stars from Mr. Bras, but another chef was asking for the same thing, and they didn't.
And ooh, how are they choosing?
Yes, and he was pretty upset, obviously, that he didn't get the same treatment, you know. And he was saying, like, it's not I don't want to be part of this family. I'm just struggling because every day it's hard for me. I don't have the financial support.
Mm-hmm. So it can have a financial impact once you get that star. In terms of keeping certain standards or staff?
I mean, in terms of standards, in terms of clientele, I'm sure, and you have like more international people coming. You're like, it's a big reward. Like Chef Michael was saying, it's like a quest. You know, it's a grail for like every chef. It's kind of a dream. You wake up and you're like, yeah, I want to have like a star, obviously, and then you want 2, and then you want 3, and then you have to keep.
Yeah.
And it's the keeping.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how you started the conversation, you know, talking about how your friends, some of them were watching football. You know, it's very interesting because when you think about sports and you think about how somebody wins and somebody loses, and so there's a finality to it. The really hard thing about being a chef, going for Michelin stars, you know, being a movie, you know, filmmaker, or being an artist, there isn't a competition. There isn't a finality. It's judgment, and you can't win or lose by playing against somebody. And so some of the things that I think really keep us all up at night is how are we going to be judged, and what is the process, and you don't know exactly the process, and that's I think where a lot of the pressure comes from. I mean, I think that it's, you know, if you're head to head and you're competing with somebody, it's one thing, but when you're not sure exactly how the competition is working, it's very hard, and so in some ways it keeps it, the pressure is enormous, but it does keep you on your toes, and I understand why it's done. Me personally, I would say that, you know, some of the you know, things you've seen in other industries, I would love to see Michelin do that in our industry, something where you have the Michelin guide and you have that, but maybe you also have something where people in your own industry get to vote and get to,
like, an insider's guide.
Yeah, just an insider's guide or something like that, where, you know, you're judged by your peers. And I think that's something that could work, you know, could also work. I think it could be I mean, I think that what Michelin has done is so brilliant in the sense of anything that's bringing attention to our industry is, you know, I look at it as a plus. It's hard.
What about bringing Michelin to Dubai?
Wow. Do I have to answer the question?
No, but is there an argument for bringing some kind of rating system to a city? I'm not sure Dubai is perhaps necessarily ready for Michelin.
Yeah.
But how as a chef, Matt, how useful would that be to you?
I mean, it really depends on the chef of the actual place itself. I mean, there's maybe a small handful of places, I think, who could actually get that here. In my humble opinion, I don't think a lot of restaurants here really aspire to do that. And especially, I think a lot of the clientele here they're not really into that style of service. I think a lot of the people here, they just want to have a lot of food on the table, and they're pretty happy, to be honest with you.
Had a message in from Susanna saying, Chef Mina is amazing. He is a genius. I've eaten at three of his restaurants. Great to hear him on air.
Guess the ingredient.
My glamorous assistant, Hadrian, is here with the first clue.
So, first clue. Today's mystery ingredient is protected by a law passed in 1955 in Italy. This law prevents the most important European dairy products from being copied.
The latest food news.
Lucky enough to have three excellent chefs who are at the very forefront of foodie knowledge. And we want to talk about some news. And actually, we're talking about drinks. This is a real nostalgic thing for me. I remember in the dark waking up and hearing the sound of the milk float going down the street and the clink, clink, clink of the milk bottles as the milkman walked up to the front door and put them down on the doorstep. Hadrian, you're French. Did people deliver the milk to your door when you were growing up?
Unfortunately, not in Paris.
No, not. They probably maybe get stolen.
but yes, when I was going on holidays to my grandma's house, like which was in Brittany and stuff like that, you got that kind of like very cool vibe, you know, when you wake up and you have stuff delivered in your doorstep, you know. And that's the beauty of that was it was like just nice products, you know, from the farm next to you. And you have like fishermen coming also. It was not only like about like milk and butter. It was like a beautiful remember that.
Really giggle at this. So I grew up in Northumberland, kind of northeast England, and we had a French guy who used to come around on a bicycle wearing a stripy t-shirt with garlic around his neck, and he would sell garlic and onions around the English countryside. I don't think he was French. I think he was maybe just trying to earn a few quid on the side.
Yeah, he was using the accent on the end.
Yeah, it was proper Franglish. Okay. And Chef Michael, Chef Matt, in the States, is this something that happens? You get milk delivered to the door?
Yeah, you know, for me, it was just same as what you said. I mean, it was my childhood, and where I grew up in the center of Washington State is very rural, and it's actually one of the for the United States, we grows all the Timothy hay that gets sent to Japan for the Wagyu beef.
Wow, brilliant!
And so the farming community was very strong, and we did have Weininger's Dairy that delivered milk to our door, and the nostalgia was just amazing. I can remember it exactly how it tastes. The emotional connection that you made with that product every day when it would come to your
and so
your
seasonal hay. I remember having the little crust of ice on the top in the winter and warm in the summer. Well, it's coming back in the UK. Milk deliveries around the UK are up nearly 5%, with a milkman saying business has gone crazy these last couple of weeks, and he thinks the BBC documentary Blue Planet 2 might have a really big factor because people are now much more conscious about use of plastic, and saying interestingly it's a younger demographic. It's
that's
the
great.
Young families in their 30s and 40s are putting in order and asking for specifically for milk in glasses. Obviously, there's a cost factor, and a kind of a 4-pint plastic bottle is about 5.5 dirhams equivalent in the UK, whereas it's more like 13 if it's in glass. Would you pay extra, Hadrian?
100%.
Yeah.
I think it's nice also to get back to what we had when we were younger and what was happening. You know, we just like changed completely. The industry was taking over it, and you can see all the chefs around the world are like fighting for that also. I think it's super important as chefs to also like teach people and teach our clients and teach also our kids and everyone around us that this is small things, but things that will become super important soon.
Mm-hmm. And the importance of provenance as well, you know, and knowing where that has come from. And if it's come from your friend who lives a mile down the road, then how amazing is that?
Absolutely.
Staying with dairy, Veganuary is happily over, she says. How about Februdairy? Is there something you've heard of, Matt?
I can't say that I have.
Februdairy is the dairy industry taking the fight back to the vegans, basically saying,
wow.
I know, bold. It's a hashtag. It's happening on Twitter. Basically, it's a month-long campaign. Februdairy is running to counter the vegan movement, aiming to showcase the dairy industry in a positive, factual way. I think a lot of people have watched documentaries on Netflix and thought, okay, now it's just going to be almond milk for me now. As a chef, Michael, I would love your kind of insight on this, on pro dairy, or how? What are your general feelings?
100% pro dairy.
Yes.
I think that you know, I don't think you could have said it any better. And chef, I don't think you could have said it any better. Every product, it's how it's where you get it from. It's how it's handled. It's how it's cared for. It's, you know, how it's how it's raised, how everything about it. And so to start to say, well, I'm just not going to eat this product or drink this product or use this product because I heard about, you know, this situation or that situation. I think you have to spend a little more time, you know, really being a little more, if you enjoy something and you think of that memory that it brought you from your childhood, spend a little more time to make sure you are getting a good product. And it is, you know, it's been properly cared for, and then, you know, enjoy your dairy.
Enjoy it. So if you want to get involved in this campaign, you can do on Twitter and Instagram. Dr. Jude Kappa, she's an independent livestock sustainability consultant, has started it by saying, let's make February happen this year. 28 days, 28 positive dairy posts, from cute calves to cheese on crumpets to belligerent bulls and juicy burgers. Who's in? So this is your chance if you want to kind of talk back. Now, someone else who's talking back to the vegans is Gordon Ramsay. Now, Chef Michael, you've been on a couple of TV programs with Mr. Ramsay?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Come on, give us the scoop. Enjoyable?
Yeah. No, I mean, look, you know, I think that, again, I think that he, Chef Ramsay, has, again, brought more attention to our industry. And I always look at that in a very positive light. I mean, I know that Chef Ramsay can cook. I've cooked with him. I've, you know, and I think that, you know, there is children that are growing up saying, I want to be a chef because of Chef Ramsay. And so, I will always say that it's, anytime that people are helping to bring attention to our industry, keep doing what you're doing.
Well, people routinely send him photos on Twitter of their culinary creations, hoping for a response or a retweet. But one person, I don't know, maybe got a bit more than she bargained for when she sent him a photo of her vegan lasagna. And he simply replied saying, I'm a member of PETA, people eating tasty animals. So I think it's safe to say he might be using the February Diary hashtag. Now,
but that's very him also. I mean, yeah. Come on, you send a picture like that, you know that you're going to get an answer.
Yeah, exactly.
You get ready for it.
Exactly. Now, speaking of celebs, now, I think presidents are perhaps a breed entirely of their own. Chef Michael Mina, you've cooked for 3 presidents.
I have.
Which
one? Yes. I have cooked for President Clinton, President Bush Jr., and President Obama multiple times.
President
Obama, okay. Yes.
Starting at the beginning, can you remember what you've cooked for each of them?
I can. President Clinton was really amazing. He came. It was right after he left the White House, and he came to a restaurant called Knob Hill, our restaurant in Las Vegas, and actually with his family, and wanted to do. Said, cook for me. Just cook for me. We don't want the menus. And it was 13 people. And what an unbelievable human being. He was in the kitchen learning how we made the bread and wanted to see the bread oven. And we cooked, you know, probably 11 courses for him.
Wow.
And then he asked me to join him. I sat down with his family. You know, we talked about food, talked about life. It was a very special experience. President Bush was a very different experience in the sense that it was for a large group. It was like 400 people. It was a function, and it was a set menu, two courses. You know, he was speaking, and so wasn't so intimate. That one was very simple. It was actually a roasted Dungeness crab soup was the first course, and then it was a filet, beef filet mignon.
You say that simple. Filet for 400 people is not that simple.
That one was. And then President Obama was extremely enjoyable because, again, it was, I would say the two highlights, three times with President Obama where I've been blessed enough to have been able to cook for him and been able to share some time with him. But the first time was in San Francisco, and I really wanted to. He was visiting, and it was during. It was actually when, you know, before, in the middle of his presidency, and so it was when he was campaigning, and it was at a home, a friend of mine's home, who was putting on a small dinner for about 20 people, and I brought all product from literally 100 miles around where the Bay Area, around San Francisco, and I really wanted to showcase not just the great produce that we have, but sturgeon, caviar, Brent Farms beef, just all local Bay Area products. And he really, you know, enjoyed the, made a point to tell me, you know, how much he enjoyed the thought that went into the meal. And then I had told him about my restaurant in Washington, D.C., Bourbon Steak. And so actually the same beef that we use here at Mina Brasserie, that we actually fly in here, it's Creekstone beef, I brought in a T-bone for him and made a wood-fired T-bone steak for him and Michelle. And and they came back, they came back for their anniversary after that, just for that steak.
That's incredible.
That's nice.
Oh, Chef Michael Mina, it's a true honor to have you this afternoon here on the Thursday brunch.
Thank you.
We've got time for one quick clue.
Guess the ingredient.
Today's mystery ingredient dates back to the Roman age. In autumn, herds of cows would make their way down from the Alps to the northern Italian village that today's mystery ingredient is named after.
I find that quite intimidating. Herds of cows make their way to the village, like they're kind of marauding. Hadrian, what is your must-have in your kitchen? First of all, in your work kitchen, and second of all, in your home kitchen?
Work kitchen, obviously, knife for me. Like, it's something I cannot work without. I will have to say that it's impossible. I cannot, like, a good knife, basically, not like any knives, a good sharpened knife.
Do you have like a favorite that you carry around and has a little name, or, you know?
Sure, they all have. No, I don't give them names, but they are all mine, and I'm very careful about them. I sharpen them. I have a lot. I have a small family, you know. I think every chef have them. I have like 6 or 7 knives, and they stay. They are like nicely wrapped. You know, you take care of them. Obviously, it's your work like tool, you know. So you have to be very careful about it.
Yeah, I have pride in that.
But I have so many tools that I love. I love like the mandolin, which you can slice very thin. Things without you can, you know, this Maries, which is for me like the best invention in the world. You can scrap everything.
What?
A Maries.
Maries. Okay, come
it's
on.
It's like a spatula, which is like plastic.
Oh, and so you can scrap more everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm very OCD, so I like to have things like very perfect and clean. So for me, it's like an amazing tool, you know.
And at home?
At home, it's a good question. I would just say like a good frying pan or a good saucepan, you know, like good quality, so you can like roast anything and fry anything. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And also, quick factoid. Where are you from, Hadrian?
What do you mean, where I'm from?
Well, your surname, Villedieu.
Yes.
Obviously. Can you give us a little background on the Villedieu?
Yeah, the Villedieu, my last name, my family name, is from like a place in France where they produce all the saucepan and frying pan like for all a lot of like very famous restaurant in France, which is like a crazy and funny story, because
it's just destiny that you're
it was a bit of a
food.
Destiny. And they do like beautiful saucepan for big chefs in the world, so that's cool. I don't even have one, so imagine.
That's bucket list.
I have to talk to my dad.
Chef Michael Mina, your must have. I mean, you've opened now 36 restaurants worldwide. Is there something that you carry with you when you travel around, or something that you feel needs to be in every single kitchen that you open?
Well, I would say I love cooking over wood, and just the idea of barbecue, just that idea of grilling and barbecue, whether I'm at home or I'm at work. I would say that every one of my kitchens has a component of it, whether it is a, you know, like at Mina Brasserie.
Well,
there
I was
we
gonna
have,
say I had the steak I had last
night. Yeah, so there we have a what's called it's a company that makes a lot of my grills for the restaurants. It's called J&R, and they make these beautiful wood burning grills. And you know, when you think of all of the different barbecue and the different grilling from around the world, whether it's Binchitan from Japan or whether it's, you know, and I would say that every one of our kitchens, we sneak one in somewhere.
Good.
And then at home, I have the same, because we're, you know, us as chefs were inside so much that I made it a, I said when we were building, you know, when we were remodeling our home, I said, I don't care what you do with the kitchen inside the house because I'm just never going to be there. I'm always going to be outside. And so I put wood burning equipment right in the center of the garden. And when people come over, I say, go grab what you want and go, here's
that
a basket, go get what you
amazing.
Want. And so, you know, put a little tin roof over it. And that's where I like to cook.
Now, you're both very happily married.
Yes.
Did cooking play a part in the wooing of your wives, Hadrian?
Absolutely.
Yes?
Absolutely.
Yes?
Big time. Yeah.
What did you cook?
I don't even remember what I cooked first, but yes, for sure, being just a chef, I think
the ladies like it.
Was already something like she was like super happy about it. Mm-hmm. And she's not really a good cook also, so I think it's great for her to have someone that knows how to cook. But she had like a lot of pressure also since the beginning, because I cook, obviously. She didn't want to get involved in the kitchen. But now more and more she's stepping in, and I'm super proud of her. That's cool.
And what's a kind of typical dish you'd cook at home as a couple, or you for her, or vice versa?
As a couple, I will never really cook because I get like really annoyed. I'm a chef, so you know, if I have someone in my kitchen that doesn't go the right way, I think that was our first fight.
Really?
Yeah. She's not listening now, but it's a shame. But
we have a podcast. We'll send it to her.
She could agree on that. That was our first fight because obviously we didn't like agree on stuff. But I tried at home to do like very simple things. I go back to my roots, you know. And as Chef Mina was saying, like if I have a barbecue, or if I can just grill something or put something in a oven and just like slow cook and roast. This is my favorite things to do. You know, like comfort food at home for me is the best.
Absolutely,
Chef Mina, was it a wooing weapon in the arsenal?
It was. You know, it really is kind of a magical story. My wife, we met. She was serving high tea at the Four Seasons, and at the time,
in San Francisco, really?
and at the time, it was right after I had told you about the earthquake that had happened in San Francisco. So my restaurant had been postponed to open it, and so I took the pastry chef job at the Four Seasons because I could work in the morning and then work on my restaurant in the evening. When I first met my wife, I asked her, you know, what her favorite flavor of ice cream was at work one morning. And she said it was chocolate fudge almond. And so I went and made it for her right away and gave it to her about 2 hours later.
Easy.
And then we were married.
And then we were married. And then it wasn't as easy as ice cream anymore. The next, on our honeymoon, it was... I haven't had caviar in a long time. What can you make me with caviar?
Amazing.
And then he went to fish some sturgeon and like process it.
A little different.
Yeah. I love it. When we come back, we're going to be tasting some of the food that you can expect in Mina Brashi. But before we go, I think we've got time for one more.
Guess the ingredient.
Hadrian.
Yes.
Can we please have clue number 3?
Yeah. Today's mystery ingredient is produced using the milk from cows in Piedmont and Lombardy in Italy. Although the cheese has been produced for over a millennia, it's acquired its greenish-blue marbling as recently as the 11th century.
Lucky enough to be joined in the studio by some fantastic chefs, including Chef Michael Mina, who has opened no less than 36 restaurants worldwide, and we're lucky enough to have his latest opening here in Dubai. Mina Brasserie, congratulations, Chef.
Thank you.
And really heartfelt thanks for, first of all, allowing me to come and have a little sneak peek last night, where the roast chicken... the mac and cheese. I mean, really just superb dining and such fun, lively atmosphere. I also have Chef Hadrian from Inked as my co-host this afternoon, keeper of the clues, and who's also holding a fork. We've had some food already.
Yes.
Chef, what have you... Chef Matt, your exec chef from Four Seasons Mina Brasserie, has been prepping some delicious food. First plate is...
chilled avocado and lobster salad.
Now, I did say off air, I have got a confession that despite avocado being the coolest of the foods, I actually am not a big fan, which means I shouldn't be allowed to be on Instagram at all.
Which is perfect for me, thanks.
Yes. So we're doing some sharing. This is absolutely delicious.
Thank you.
So the components of some pickled vegetables, we've got pickled cauliflower in there, pickled red onion, really buttery lobster, and then crispy phyllo as well.
Yes.
Tell us, how did you come up with the concept?
Keep going. Let's see how you did. You did well. You got almost everything.
Tell me about the, does it say it was called Sham?
Shug.
Shug.
Yeah, and so the idea behind, I mean, really kind of...
You can clink and clink. You're allowed to eat on the Thursday brunch. Sorry. Don't worry.
I would say growing up in a Middle Eastern household, one thing that I would say with all of my cooking, it's very bold in the flavor. Flavor to me is important, flavor forward. But when you cook, you know, when you cook with bold flavors, you really have to understand balance, and you really have to understand the use of spice, acid, sweetness, and fat or richness. And this dish is kind of exemplifies all of
it
them, right?
Really does, because you've got that heat coming from the pickle, which is then cooled down by the avocado puree. You've got puree and you've got a cube form on there as well.
Yeah, the avocado gives you the fat and the richness in that dish. You've got the shug, which gives you the spice and the heat.
So shug is, you said, like a...
It's like a hot sauce in Middle Eastern. You know, you've got usually different peppers in it that are roasted, and so olive oil, citrus.
Like a chimichurri style.
Yeah, very similar to what... chimichurri would be. And then you get the pickled vegetables, which have some sugar in them, and those are going to give you the sweetness. And so the idea for me always behind food is, how do you balance, you know, when I taste food, I'm always tasting to say, is there the right amount of acid? Is there the right amount of sweetness? Is there the right amount of fat? And is there the right amount of spice in the dish? And when any one of those is out of sync, that's when, you know, a dish, usually you get bored of a dish pretty quick, or you don't enjoy a dish. But when they are all balanced well, I think that's when you can really enjoy a dish.
And that crispy phyllo on top, just it's a little crunch that carries you through. But also the crunch of the pickled vegetable and the radish. It's just a very fresh, you know, moving into spring now. Beautiful as well. We'll post some photos on our social media so you can have a little look at what we're tasting. Hadrian, a fan?
I'm a big fan. I will not talk too long about it because obviously Chef explained everything about it, but it's super nice to have something refreshing. And also I'm a huge fan of pickled, so like anything pickled on top can like create an amazing taste, and he explained it properly. Some people just think that sometimes as a chef we just like throw ingredients in a plate, but he explained the full process behind, which is interesting, because it's in this plate you can see his background basically, and you know, and you see like the lobster, the avocado, the Middle Eastern like influence for here. It's super cool, super fresh, and very nice. I won't share it, sorry.
I am not going to get it back. Okay, great. That's Chef Mina, after of all these restaurants around the world, we're talking Europe, Vegas, you've got a few, obviously the Bay Area as well.
Yes.
Is there one dish that you're really the most proud of that you feel exemplifies your style and your cooking?
It's always hard to say, is there one dish personally? Because a lot of times your customer will decide your dish for you. And I would say if there's one dish, there's probably two. They're both on the menu here at the Brasserie. One of them I'm very proud of, because when I opened Aqua in 1991, you could not give tuna tartare away. You couldn't give it away.
Not
people
interested.
Understood steak tartare in the United States. You couldn't give away tuna tartare, and nobody was doing it. And I remember doing my version of it because it was a play, you know, because Aqua was an all fish restaurant. And I was very focused on never serving, you know, really taking classic meat dishes and doing fish
interpretations.
And the tuna tartare was a play on steak tartare, and so, you know, it was done with pears, pine nuts, scotch bonnet peppers, sesame oil, chili powder, as opposed to what you would find, you know, the capers, the red onions, the olive oil, I would go to every table and mix it just to sell it. And you would sell two or three a night.
Passion product.
And I would say now we probably sell Probably tonight we'll probably sell 700 of them across the restaurants.
Wow. You know? But you were there before it became cool. And it is, as you say, on the Meenup restaurant menu.
Yeah.
How is it prepared and served?
It's exactly the same. It's always been the same. Anytime we try and change it, it's not a good idea.
You do have a steak tartare on the Meenup restaurant
we
menu.
We do have a steak
tartare. How's that prepared?
So that is actually done very classically. And so you got capers, red onions, olive oil, parsley, black pepper, a little bit of Parmesan, and then it's all mixed table side, and then we serve it with grilled bread.
That's what I really enjoyed last night, actually. There was, I was going to say ceremony, but that sounds stuffy, but the fact that our roast chicken was served and you jointed at the table and served up,
yes,
really felt very special. Now, can you just tell me how you make that roast chicken?
Okay,
because there is
no way in
the world I've ever had crispy skin like that, or will ever be able to prepare that at home. How do you do it?
The good news about it is you probably won't be able to do it at home.
Okay, so it's an impossible dream.
That's very good news for Chef Michael.
So what we do is we'll brine the chicken, rub the skin with a little bit of salt just to pull the moisture out of it, hang it, you know, put it next to a fan in the walk-in so it blows on it for at least a day.
Don't do that at home.
Don't do that at home. And then the way we do it is we actually steam it for about 15 minutes in our combi oven, on our rational oven, and so it sets the chicken, and then we fry the whole chicken in duck fat. And so that's what gets it so crispy.
It's unbelievable. And it's served with broccolini,
black truffle macaroni and cheese, and then a caramelized onion, again, kind of playing off of that sweetness, a caramelized onion and black truffle jus.
Something else that really caught my attention on the menu last night, and again, it was a sharing dish, was your lobster pot pie.
Yeah, so that's the other dish. I would say that you did great. You've actually picked pretty much three of the classics that are in a lot of the restaurants.
Thanks very much, Chef.
The lobster pot pie is another one that, is 20 years, 21 years. And and funny enough, you know, we were talking about my wife earlier. This started out because my wife, loves to entertain and have, you know, 30 people at our house.
And then go, Michael, you're cooking.
Yeah, and she's like, on a Sunday, which was my one day off, and she's like, okay, I really am in the mood for lobster. And so I couldn't imagine myself sitting there on a Sunday and breaking down 30 lobsters, right? And so I did a giant, in a roasting pan, I did this giant lobster pot pie and, wrapped the whole pan with paste, with pie dough pastry, and as you said, slow cooking, put it in the oven, relax, and it got such a response that after that we kind of refined it and brought it to the restaurants, and now what we do is we bake it in a beautiful copper pot, and then the waiter will come to the table and carve it out of the pot, and so the whole dining room smells like, and we bring in the Maine lobsters from, we bring in beautiful Maine lobsters, and so we make a cognac and truffle lobster sauce that we put into the pot.
Quite light, then.
So, no, that one isn't quite light.
But, and a shell food bisque as well.
Yeah.
Because our server last night was very funny at explaining, saying that any allergies, because this has dairy and gluten and shellfish. And I was like, this sounds incredible.
So it's a real new hashtag that you can create.
Yeah, no, hashtag no allergies.
No allergies.
But yeah, a real star.
Yeah.
And is that something that appears on your menus worldwide as well?
Yeah, I would say that that's on more than half of our menus. Yeah.
Now, I need to ask Chef Michael to go really back to basics. What's your very first memory of food?
My mom's bread, and her bread is very, it's a cross between traditional pocket bread and laffa bread. It's kind of a cross right between it, and she would bake it, on the racks in the oven, and always would do it first thing in the morning, and I remember smelling it. I remember as a little kid grabbing the rack in the oven and burning my hand. But
that's good practice for your future career.
But I would say that that's, would be my first memory of food.
And Hadrian?
I think will be like my grandmother apricot pie. She has a beautiful garden, wow. And she was just like I was from the trees and bringing it to her, and she was always giving me some raw dough, you know, to eat. So that I think that's a mix of everything: a raw dough and some apricot pie that she was doing. And the smell, I can still smell that today.
And what was the first thing that you cooked that you remember being like, I have really cooked something, chef?
I would say. Really, I would say, like, at the restaurant, my first job in the first restaurant, and I remember watching the lead cook poach salmon. And I would say the reason that it was such a vivid memory for me is because one thing that my mom was a great cook, but boy, if she's cooking salmon right now, it is going to be in the oven for the next 2 hours.
Not a light touch.
And I remember tasting that salmon the first time that I had it cooked properly and saying, you know, I realized that I'd never tasted salmon in my life before. And it was done with hollandaise and it was just poached salmon with hollandaise and asparagus. And I remember going home, buying all the ingredients from the store and then trying to make it. And I broke the hollandaise probably 5 times. but finally, I got it right.
I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Chef Michael Mina, world-class restaurant and entrepreneur. We are celebrating the opening of his new restaurant, Mina Brasserie. And if you'd like the chance to go and try it as well, I'm very happy to say we've also been treated to another dish. Chef Michael, what's in front of us?
Oh, you have truffle mac and cheese that Chef Matt made for you.
Matt.
Like truffle macaroni and cheese.
Matt, you've done it on another level. Obviously, the restaurant's a little bit different. Here in the studio, we're making it a somewhat different technique, but delicious. What's in it and how do you make it?
So we have a truffle mac and cheese with a little bit of chopped black truffle inside. We make a bechamel that's slightly diluted with cream. And then our three cheese mixture of Parmesan, Gorgonzola, and white cheddar.
That was me having another bite. It is so delicious, so creamy, so comforting, but not... Obviously, we have a thing in England about loving beige food, you know, like all your kind of... And it's creamy, but it's got such flavor, and it goes back to that balance you were talking about earlier, Chef Mina. It really, it's bright, it's flavorful, but also so comforting. Hadrian, you've been enjoying it as well.
Yeah, I don't want to talk anymore. I'm just going to eat. But it's super well balanced. As you said, you feel every product, like the three cheese, you feel the truffle, and it's not overpowerful. So it's, again, a very good one.
And this is a side at Mina Brasserie. I had this with the chicken last night, but you can actually order it as a side with anything, right?
Yes.
What other sides are being served up at the restaurant, Matt?
We have a really lovely ratatouille.
Do you know what our server said to me last night? He's like, we have a ratatouille. It's just like the one in the film. And I was like, what?
prepared he
by a rat? What?
that's our dynamic selling techniques at Mina Brasserie.
I haven't seen the film, so I didn't know what he meant, but maybe it is. So ratatouille, we had some truffle fries last night.
Truffle fries, always a winner. We have honey soy glazed Brussels sprouts, which, you know, my mom, she couldn't get me to eat Brussels sprouts when I was a kid if her life depended on it, but these are really lovely. Loaded baked potato as well, which is pretty great.
Loaded with what?
Yeah, so we take we roast the potatoes, we core it out, then deep fry the shell, and then we pipe in mashed potatoes with a little bit of white cheddar, broccoli, and of course some bacon bits just to top it all off.
Yummy. This is just fantastic. You're looking very, very content over here.
Yeah, wow.
But we would like you to go out and have a good time too. So if you know our mystery ingredient, get in touch 4001 or via the Dubai iMessenger app. That's also the number to get in touch if you'd like to win 500 dirhams to spend at the Nippon Bottle Company. It's a little hidden away spot behind a bookcase in the Dusit Tani, Dubai. And if you want to win, all you need to do is tell us what your essential kitchen ingredient or item is. I've had some really good suggestions. Thermomix. Guys, can you tell me what a Thermomix is and should I have one? They seem very expensive. Is it worth it? Do you guys use them? Adrian?
We have one at the restaurant.
You do, Matt?
If I would need this in my house, I don't know about this. It would be my first choice of ingredient, but it is a great tool to have. It blends, but it also... combines temperature control. So you could actually cook a hollandaise in it without heating anything.
Wow.
So it is nice. Personally, I would rather have a Vitamix blender than the Thermomix, but that's just me personally.
Chef Adrian, do you guys have one at Inked?
We don't have one at Inked because we have also like very good blenders, so we don't really need it. And I have to say that I think like most chefs use the Thermomix more like as a blending tool, more than like a real cooking tool.
Because you can get like great big cookbooks on the Thermomix, making literally anything, baking in it.
It's more like, a good chef's help at home, you know, when you don't want to be bothered to use a free saucepan, and you can do like Chef Matthew said, like a nice Hollandaise that will never split and everything. That will stay proper. So it's more like for a very good tool for home if you really want to do things like that can be proper.
Chef Matt, chef at the Four Seasons Mina Brasserie, what's your kind of must-have ingredient at home? What's always in the pantry?
I'm going to go with the most basic and say salt. I have a very voracious salt tooth.
Really?
If the food is not salted, I don't think I can eat it at all.
Oh, it's a tricky one with chefs and salt though, because some restaurants you don't put salt on the table at all. And kind of the expectation being that we've done our seasoning and this is how it goes. We've had a couple of instances. My husband is also very into salty food. I think it's actually years of smoking, to be honest, not that he would accept that as truth, where he's salted food and had chef come over and say, oh, you have some criticism of my seasoning. And that's pretty awkward situation. And he's gone, no, it's just delicious. But tell me about salting at different stages of the cooking. Because you obviously it's kind of during and then after. How does that work, Chef Matt?
I mean, it all depends on what you're cooking. You know, if you're doing some sort of sauce, you may want to do it at the end. Because if the mixture is reducing, obviously it'll become increasingly saltier depending on the length of time. Obviously, like a steak, we would season that before we cook it, but it's nice to have some large flake of some salt that give it some added texture, and that little burst of salt on the tongue as you eat it makes a huge difference.
You know, I'm just asking you questions so I can sit and eat mac and cheese and not have to say for a few minutes. Now, we have got our mystery ingredient competition for your chance to win dinner for two at Mina Brasserie. That's including some of the chef's favourite dishes and house beverages. All you need to do is tell us what the mystery ingredient is. Chef Adrian?
Guess the ingredient.
Can we please have our fifth clue?
So the blue veins in today's mystery ingredient contain anti-inflammatory properties that can help reduce joint inflammation and relieve arthritis pain. It is a good source of calcium and phosphorus. However, it also has a high calorie content and best eaten in moderation.
Food fantasy.
Food fantasy. Chef Michael Mina, you have had decades of experience cooking and opening restaurants around the world. You've traveled everywhere, cooked for presidents. What is your ultimate food fantasy?
Well, I would say there's a chef in the United States. He's from Japan. His name is Chef Masa. He is in New York, in Central Park, at the Time Warner building. And the first time I ate at his restaurant, it was kind of a life changing experience for me. I love Japanese food. I love everything about it. I love the relentlessness in which they do everything, whether it's the procurement of product, the handling, the skill, the technique. And Chef Masa, I think he's the best in the United States. And so when I went to the restaurant and actually we became, acquaintances and friends, and he has promised me a trip to Japan where he's going to take me around.
Wow.
And so he's promised me it for about 10 years now. So I'd say it's
down,
become
chef.
My fantasy, because
you don't think it's going to happen?
Every time that I see him,
he teases you and I
bug him about it. And so I would say that it's my fantasy now, because I just think that when you get the chance to travel with a chef that's their home, where they were trained, and then all of then somebody that's as decorated as Chef Masa, obviously I would imagine that I would see a different side of Japan, and it still is, is definitely my favorite food city to travel to, Tokyo.
That sounds incredible. Can I come, please?
Sure.
Thanks.
If I ever get a go.
Okay, deal. Chef Matt, exec chef, Mina Brasserie, same question to you. Food fantasy.
growing up in Chicago, we ate a lot of very hearty foods, and definitely a very staple in Chicago is sausage. When I worked at for Michael, my first joint was at a local market in Florida, and he let me curate the butchery program there. And over my course of my time there, I had 42 different flavors of sausage from around,
wow.
I think, 11 or 12 different animals. And for me, I think it would be really cool to go down to South America, specifically the Amazon. And I'm really fascinated by some of the, like, really historic ways of cooking things in pits and burying things underground and wrapping it in clay and cooking it. And I would just try to see how many animals I could go down there and find and turn into sausage.
Like a travel, hunting, cooking expedition.
It's a full expedition, and definitely there would be some fishing involved as well.
A sausage expedition.
Chef Hadrian, tell me.
Yeah, I think it's very, very difficult to answer that question. I have to say, I'm like Chef Michael. I've never been to Japan, but I'm planning it for this summer, so I'm going to finally try some amazing food. I'm very into Japanese food and also culture and everything. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that now, if I can just snap and go somewhere, I will go on a beach in Spain and just have some grilled fish or a nice paella or some tapas. Something very straightforward, simple. I'm a Spanish lover, so I love that.
Yeah.
Very easy things.
That does sound fantastic.
Guess the ingredient.
Okay, we're ready.
Today's mystery ingredient is part of Chef Michael Mina's mac and cheese recipe featured on the menu at Mina Brasserie.
So my second confession of the day is that my mac and cheese is gone. Hadrian, yours is still, you're trying to hold back, making it last.
I know what's going on behind me, so I know that I'm going to have to keep some space. You know?
Now, Matt, what's next for us?
Next up, we have the foie gras mousse. It's kind of a play on the classic peanut butter and jelly, if you will, but with foie gras.
Okay, so that's a big play.
We've set foie gras mousse at the bottom with a raspberry balsamic gelée, a little bit of crushed peanut on top just for some added texture. It's just a very simple, shareable dish.
That's what I'm talking about.
I'm digging in.
Dive right in.
You knew what was coming.
Get a little bit of both layers, spread it on the bread, and call it a day.
Okay. This looks amazing. Smells very peanutty, hey? Okay, I'm going to try and not get it on the microphone right now. So, and tell me about the raspberry, kind of setting that off like a little acidic touch.
It's nice to have, the foie is so fatty, it's nice to have something with a little bit of sweetness, but also a little bit of acidity to kind of help to balance the palate.
Oh my goodness me. It's so creamy. As you say, that raspberry adds such a brightness to it. You've got that depth of flavor from the foie gras, and then it's just completely lightened up. And then the nuts are so unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is you bringing a little bit of Americana to the Dubai shores.
A little bit.
I want to see Chef Hadrian's face as he has this as well.
Our peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Oh my goodness. The poshest peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
They definitely didn't look like this when I was growing up.
So creamy.
Wow.
This is a starter on the Mina Brasserie menu?
It is,
yes. And you would encourage people to share?
Absolutely. It's very heavy. So, I mean, it's good, great to share with 2-3 people and just have one piece of bread,
and
it's
you've
great.
Got those three textures. You've got that creaminess of the foie gras, you've got that jelly, and then the kind of crunch of the nut coming through along with the bread as well. And which bread? We have a little, just a simple sourdough.
Just a very classic baguette that we would lightly brush in olive oil and grill over the wood fire.
Can I get your verdict, Chef Hadrian?
Oh wow, I was really waiting for that one, and I know why now. I think it's brilliant because they play on like the peanut butter and jelly like sandwich, but also in France we used to do a lot of foie gras mousse or royale, and then on top we always add a layer of something, either like a Xeres reduction or, you know, something like that to balance the acidity. And they played on both of these games, and wow, that's super cool. I'm going to keep it for me.
Whose invention, Chef Michael?
Yes.
Over, and where and when was it devised?
This was devised maybe 10, yeah, same back in probably 10, 15 years ago. And again, at Aqua, even though it was an all-fish restaurant, we used the most foie gras in the United States. And so
wow.
We cheated. It
That's
was fish
no
and foie
joke.
Gras. And so this was part of a dish that we would do with a hot and cold. It was a duo. And so we would do the cold version like this. And then next to it, there would be a sauteed piece of foie gras. And depending on what fruit was in season, it would be cooked with the, you know, with the fruit. And
what kind of fruits?
It just depends on what's in season.
Literally, and it could be
literally
anything.
Yeah, it's delicious with mangoes, apples, pineapples. It's really apricots, whatever's in season. You know, it's all about seasonality when it comes to fruit.
And Chef Matt, how are you finding with sourcing here in Dubai? You're bringing in, as I said, Maine lobster. You've got foie gras. The restaurant really is all different kind of, not necessarily cuisines, but ingredients from all over the world.
Right. In Dubai, you have to be, because unless you want dates or camel, you're not going to get too many local products. But what's interesting is that you can have really great European products, let's say in the peak of their, in their time from the Northern Hemisphere. And then when it's the Southern Hemisphere's turn to be in season, you're getting products out of South Africa and Australia. So you can almost have things year-round, which is kind of what we've come to know as chefs as the exact thing not to do. But it's, unfortunately, Dubai, you just don't have much locality. So
we would be seeing that on the menu then at Mina Brasserie with asparagus season. Are you doing anything with game in terms of things like game season? Or
Not necessarily too much game. I mean, we have things like duck and lamb. That's about as crazy as we've gotten there.
There's a duck burger on the menu.
There is.
Can you tell me about that?
I love this duck burger. It's super fatty and unctuous. We have a layer of red onion jam, then Gruyere, and then it's topped with duck confit, just right on top of the beef patty and a little bit of truffle aioli.
It's the poshest burger in Dubai. Well, really, congratulations. What other menu highlights do you think that people should be looking out for when they visit Mina Brasserie, Chef Matt?
I mean, definitely the steaks. As simple as it is, just to have a properly grilled steak over wood fire, there's not really much that beats that.
And tell us about you saying, Chef Mina, it was this Creekstone. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the kind of provenance of that.
Creekstone is mostly based out of the Midwest of the U.S., so very much cattle country where they're raised on grass but also corn-fed. Anybody who tells you that they just want to eat grass-fed beef doesn't really like to eat beef, and they don't really know anything about beef. You need fat in there in order to really taste the cow. We do get it there. It's non-GMO, so non-hormone product as well.
And I saw a ribeye strip, and what else do you have?
Tenderloin? And
filet.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And then our burger grind, which is chuck and brisket.
How do you respond when someone asks for a well-done steak? As a chef, does your heart sink a little bit, or you kind of think the customer's always right?
To be honest, I mean, being here in Dubai, you just kind of get used to it.
You go with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some tricks that you can, you know, that you can do to keep it, to cook it well done, but to also keep it from being
it soft. Yeah.
Really dry.
Ooh, like
hard.
What? Don't say give away your secrets, but give me a hint.
We do a lot of a lot of our steaks. Sometimes we'll slow poach them in butter.
Yeah. Wow.
And so
butter's always just seems. Whenever I speak to a chef, butter is just always the answer.
Yeah. So if you slow poach a filet for 45 minutes or an hour in butter and then grill it, you're going to get less shrinkage when you try
goodness
to.
Me.
It's actually interesting because, you know, the meat, it just seals it. It doesn't actually saturate it. You won't get, you would never know if I didn't tell you. If I didn't tell you that a steak was poached in butter, you'd never know that it was. Because you can start with a pan of butter, poach 50 steaks in them at the end of the night, and you've only, you know, lost about the same amount of butter as you would use olive oil to brush on your steak before you cook it, you know.
Yeah, and I think like Chef said, when you use also like good products, you know, even if you go a bit over like kind of like well done, you still get that amazing like texture of products. So it's obviously it's a bit of a shame, but after it's that. And I think there is a big fear of like, you know, clients that are scared of like the blood and everything that goes out from a steak, but they have to also make maybe more research. Like basically there is no more blood, it's myoglobin, and it's not enough, it's not any more blood. So it's not like this kind of like disgusting thing, you know, so it's more also like to learn about your product, so you know how to eat it properly and how to also eat it the right way with good flavors. You know, you don't want to overcook either a carrot because it's not good.
We are joined this afternoon by Chef Michael Mina, Chef Matt, who's the exec chef at the new Mina Brasserie, opened at the Four Seasons, and Chef Hadrian, joined in the studio by Chef Michael Mina, who has opened now 36 restaurants worldwide, and we are lucky enough to have his latest opening here in Dubai, Mina Brasserie, opening at the Four Seasons DIFC on Sunday. Chef Matt Dalcomper, his exec chef, is also joining us in the studio, and Chef Hadrian from Inked is here as well, my co-taster and co-host. Now, Chef Michael, you've been in business now since early 90s. Can you tell us, you and a certain sportsar have a very special business relationship?
Yes. Well, two amazing human beings, but Andre Agassi and Stephanie Graf.
How did this happen?
You know, it's funny because, you know, Andre is born and raised in Las Vegas, and when I opened my restaurant in Las Vegas with at the Bellagio, everyone would talk to me about Andre being, you know, really like I was part of the foundation that he did. You know, we would do events with his foundation for his charter school, and I never met him. And then he moved to San Francisco for a minute of his life, for like a year. And I actually met him when he was in San Francisco. He came into the restaurant and I met him, and we became very close friends. And when in 2002, I split up with my ex-partner with Aqua and went out on my own. And Andre said, I want to, you know, we said, I want to be your, you know, me and Stephanie want to be your partner and your sole partner. And they got me started. And it's been just an unbelievable relationship since the first day. I mean, he is as competitive as he was on the court.
Oh,
I'll
wow.
tell you, when he cooks, he's more competitive.
Really?
Yeah.
Is he a good cook?
Yeah, he's a good cook. He loves to grill. But he is, you know, he's, this is how good of a cook he is. He has a Rationale oven, a combi oven next to his wood burning grill outside.
Okay, so for those of us who don't know, us non-chefs, what is a Rationale oven?
It's a professional oven that does like steaming or like convection, so you can cook basically anything inside.
He
it's very, it's very chef oriented, professional
really?
Kitchen.
Yeah.
Wow. And then you've also launched another venture with another sports star.
Yeah. So I am kind of a sports fanatic, but Ayesha Curry, Stephen Curry's wife, is a really talented, you know, and young chef who is doing multiple things in the food industry, in the food world in the United States. And we launched a concept called International Smoke. And it's we launched our first one in San Francisco. And it's really an amazing, it's been a really amazing restaurant. I've never really opened a restaurant that has been, you know, this over the top as far as, you know, 4 months to get a reservation. You can't.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it's grilling and barbecue from all over the world.
That sounds amazing.
It's a very cool concept.
So after decades in business and living a life of food, what's been the real high point for you as a chef?
It's always going to be about, I mean, food has, you can never, I could never sit here and we need a 5-day long show to be able to say how grateful you are for what food has done for me in my life. I would have never imagined that, you know, the people that I've been able to meet, the places I've been able to visit, the culture that I've been, you know, able to learn about and be part of. But always at the end of it, I mean, I think that no matter what, I mean, you know, as a chef, you know, the greatest satisfaction about this business is just there's a camaraderie about it that it's really hard to explain if you're not part of it. Here I'm sitting next to Chef right now, and we just met each other, and you feel like you've known each other for 10 years. It's just something about there's something about our industry that's really special.
Adrian, would you agree in that?
Yeah, 100%. He's like, it's super true. It's a giant family, basically, and I cannot more agree on that. And meeting all the people you can meet, your mentor, the chefs you meet every day, and also your team. Big up to all the chefs' team, because they are always behind the chef or the executive chef, and they are amazing. Without them, we cannot do anything. So
that's really lovely to hear. So, Chef Michael Mina, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Chef Matt, the restaurant is opening on Sunday. People can make reservations now. It's Four Seasons DIFC. In a quick snapshot, what can we expect from Mina Brasserie?
Very approachable, very delicious food.
Chef Michael, anything to add to that?
Unbelievable ambiance. I think that anybody that had visited the space previously, please come back, because the ambiance, the patio is breathtaking. We have a bar out on the patio and a bar in the restaurant, and both of them, it's just really a breathtaking room. It's worth seeing.
And Chef Adrian, I cannot let you leave without revealing our mystery ingredient.
Oh, finally, I'm so happy. I cannot wait anymore.
Tell me, what is it?
Gorgonzola.
Gorgonzola. So the winner of our mystery ingredient competition was Maya. Phone number ending 4617. We will be in touch, and you have won dinner for two at Mina Brasserie. And that is with some of the chef's favourite dishes and including House of Beverages. I'm Helen Farmer. This has been the Thursday Brunch. Thank you, chefs, for joining us this afternoon.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.